Okay, the meeting is What Keeps Me Here. And our first speaker is Rhonda R. And now I'll turn the meeting over to Rhonda.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Olivia. My heart is like racing right now. I need to calm down. So I want to start off by thanking the committee for asking me to speak, and particularly Amy is the person who reached out to me. And when I was first asked, my first immediate reaction was like, hell no, I cannot do that. I feel like I've been in like total isolation for a really long time, and I've been dealing with some really very emotional feelings, and being in isolation was starting to feel good to me. And the thought of having to come out and face all of you and be around all of you and speak in front of all of you is really kind of terrifying. Even after I've been clean for 34 years, but I'm not feeling like an old timer right now. The topic, when they told me what the topic was, I thought, that's funny that I got that topic, because what keeps me here, or like why am I still here, was a question that I asked myself every single day my entire first year of recovery. And I remember like it was yesterday that I would like wake up every day and think, why am I still here? Why do I keep doing all these things that these people keep telling me I have to do, and I don't want to do them? And I had moved to Baltimore to get clean. I was most of my addiction took place in Miami. So I came from Miami to Pennsylvania to go to treatment, and then from Pennsylvania to Baltimore, and I was living in a recovery halfway house. And I had to go to meetings every day, and you know, I had rules that I had to follow. I had a curfew, and you know, and I every single day I followed all those rules. I was like a model resident, but I just didn't understand why I was doing it, and because I wasn't like really a very compliant person, you know. In the previous years during my addiction, I like did everything I wasn't supposed to. I didn't listen to anybody, and I just couldn't understand. And there were days when I felt like something had taken control of my body and was like making me get up every day and take a shower and go to a noon meeting. And then those NA people hijacked me and at the noon meeting and made me go to wherever they were going, and which resulted in maybe like two or one more or maybe two more meetings in a day. And then next thing I know, it was like, you know, 10 o'clock at night, and I just couldn't wait to go home and go to bed. And then like I would just wake up the next day and do the same thing over again. I had a boyfriend in Miami, a man that I was living with, who was still using. And every day I told everybody that I was going back to Miami. I really believed every day when I said this that I learned so much about staying clean, and I was going to go back to Miami and get him clean. And I couldn't wait to, like, I just thought if I could just get down here and tell him all this stuff, that we could get clean together. And every person I told that to laughed and said, that's not going to work. And I also, the other thing that I said every day, and I don't know why I never did it, was that I was going to just smoke marijuana. Like, cocaine was my problem, and I was just going to smoke marijuana. But, you know, not today. And that was like really the whole first maybe 6 months of my recovery. It was like this battle every day in my head, and this asking myself, like, I just don't understand why I'm still here. And then at some point There were a lot of people in my family, you know, people who knew me using, who did not believe that I could get clean and stay clean. And they every chance they got, they told me that. You know, every time they talked to me, they would start off with, "Are you still clean?" And it was really, it really irritated me at first. And there were times when it made me feel like, you know what, F it, I'm just gonna go use. But then I got to a point where I got an I'll show them attitude. And that is really what got me to 1 year clean. Every single day I woke up and I said, I am going to show them I am not going to use today. I'm going to celebrate 1 year clean, and my whole entire family is going to come here to Baltimore, and they are going to be there at my 1 year anniversary, and they are going to hear everybody say that I'm clean because they don't believe me. And I remember that day. Walking, my family came, and we walked from my home group was around the corner from where I was living, and we walked from where I was living to my home group. And on that walk, I remember thinking in my head, so now what? And I mean, I remember that conversation so well. I remember what I was wearing. I remember everything about that walk to my home group and me like thinking like, so what am I going to do now? And I really wasn't sure if I needed to continue to stay clean. And, you know, I could still maybe go back to Miami. My boyfriend was still there. And I just wasn't sure, you know, what I was going to do. But the one thing that was good for me was the fact that all of the friends that I had made in Baltimore were all in recovery. I didn't have any friends that were not in recovery. I got a job when I had 6 months clean, and I worked with people who were not in recovery, but I did not socialize with them. And so I think when I think about, you know, what kept me clean, like after that point, after I proved that I could do it, it was really all of you. You know, it was all of you. And I think about, and I also have to say that I do think it was God as well. And, you know, I think God put me right where I was supposed to be, and God put the people in my life that I needed to be in my life. And I used to think about using, and I would think that if when I did, that I would have no friends, that I would be in a city all by myself, or I didn't know anybody, because you all would drop me quick if I started using. I really did believe that. And it's funny because, you know, I'm sharing this meeting with Danny, and I could say, like, Danny is one of those reasons why I'm still here, and you know where I'm going with this, right? So there was a day in my recovery when I really, really did want to use, and I had actually made the decision that I was going to drink, which was really blew my mind because drinking was really not something that I really liked to do. But I think I was afraid to try to cop in Baltimore, so I went to a liquor store. That was safe. And so I went to a liquor store and I bought a bottle of vodka. And what I was dealing with at the time was a relationship breakup. Of course, right, surprise, surprise. And so I was in a relationship with a man in NA who started seeing another woman in NA. And I was devastated and I wanted to use. And so I went to the liquor store and I bought a bottle of vodka and I brought it home and I set it on my coffee table and I sat there and I stared at it. I don't know how long, but it felt like, when I think back, it seemed like it was hours, but I stared at that bottle of vodka, trying to decide, do I want to or do I not want to? And I remember going into the bathroom, and I had a piece of paper, because I had a sponsor who said to me, you need to come up with a game plan of, you know, what are you going to do when you ever feel like using? And you need to come up with that now while you're in a good headspace and not wait till you're there and you want to use and have to figure out what to do. So I want you to think of three things that you will do when you want to use. I want you to write it on a piece of paper and tape it to your bathroom mirror. So I had this note on my bathroom mirror that had been there for a really long time, and it had been there so long that I just didn't even notice that it was there anymore. But on this day, I went into the bathroom, and I saw that note, and the first thing on the note was, call somebody. And I thought about my conversations with my sponsor, and I thought, okay, she's going to kill me if I don't do at least one thing on this list first. So I'm going to call somebody. So I called Danny and told him that I had a bottle of vodka sitting in front of me. And Danny was watching a basketball game, wasn't it, Danny? Was it a basketball game? And he told, because I know, I think I said, you know, what are you doing? He's like, I'm watching a basketball game. So I told him, and he said, hold on a minute. And he put the phone down, and I could hear the TV, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And I'm thinking, this motherfucker, I'm like calling him, telling him I'm getting ready to use, and he's got me holding on because he's watching a damn basketball game. And I was really getting pissed. And next thing you know, bam, 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 he's at my door. He saved my life that day. And he stormed in the house, went straight for the bottle of vodka. I'm like, what is he doing? You gonna talk to me? You know, like, he just grabbed the bottle of vodka. You check. I thought that for a minute, like maybe he's gone to the kitchen to get some ice. But he checked the seal, right, Danny? Tell him. The seal was not broken, right? And he took it to the kitchen and opened the bottle and poured it down the sink. And then took me to my sponsor's house. And then got on the phone and called people who were close to me. And they showed up at my sponsor's house. And once again, you know, like they hijacked me and they took my car keys, took my house keys, and for the next several days I was held hostage and taken to one NA meeting after another. And in every meeting, it was a group of us that went to every meeting, and every meeting one of them raised their hand. And then when they got called on, said, I'm calling on Ron. Yeah. So, you know, and it, you know, there were moments when I was like really pissed off, and but here I am today, you know, with 34 years clean. And thank you. But, you know, and the other thing about, you know, like the relationships that I have built in this, in NA, I really do believe are the biggest reasons why I'm still here. And I think this is a place that you can't, like, do this in isolation. You know, when I first got clean, I didn't have a car. And every single day I called my mom and said, when are you going to buy me a car? And she wouldn't buy me a car. And it was the best thing for me. And I hated her. I thought that it was, like, abusive that she would, like, had me in this city by myself. I didn't know how to get anywhere. I had to ride public transportation for the first time in my life. I had to learn how to ride a bus. But what happened was, not having a car forced me to have to ask people for rides so I didn't have to take the bus. And that's how I got to know people. You know, that's how my relationships early in recovery, you know, really started. And, you know, then I became really good friends with Lydia, and Lydia had a car. So we went everywhere together. And I don't know, it's just like so many people, and the relationship that I have with my sponsor, you know, that also has contributed greatly to why I'm still here today. And you know, my sponsor is like, I always tell her that she's the first person that I ever really truly trusted, think I really learned about unconditional love and trust through the relationship that I have with my sponsor. And I don't think that she hates when I say this, but I do not think that I would still be here today if it were not for her, because she taught me about the steps. You know, she taught me about being a woman. You know, she taught me about life, like how to handle things without using. One of her favorite things that she used to say to me was like, stick and stay, don't use no matter what. And I heard that in my head a lot, especially during those moments when I wanted to give up, you know, and I would think about her. I would hear her voice saying, you gotta stick and stay, don't quit, stick and stay. And I never wanted to like see myself as a quitter. But you know, and it's like you never know, like as you meet people in Narcotics Anonymous, like you never know where your help is going to come from. And be careful who you judge, because God just might teach you understanding. And you know, the person, the woman that that my boyfriend back then, he wasn't really my boyfriend, but that's what I thought he was. The woman that he left me for is the woman that I came here with today. And she's one of my really good friends. And I don't know where I would be today if it wasn't for you, Gina. And I think the other thing that keeps me here is that I have developed a really healthy, huge, enormous fear of using. And that fear comes from the fact that I have seen a lot of my friends die. You know, you don't stay here for as long as I've been here and not see people die from this disease. Mm-hmm. And including most recently my husband. So, after my husband got 10 years clean, he had an accident and started taking pain medicine, and which, you know the rest of the story. His drug of choice was heroin, and I watched him for the next several years get clean on and off, until last October when I found him overdosed on the bathroom floor. And it's been really hard, but I'm still here because of people like Gina, you know, and Lydia, and Danny, and my sponsor. And, you know, people have just, like, I know I'm not alone. Like, I wake up every day and I feel alone because my husband is gone, but I know I'm not alone. And sometimes I think about, like, where would I be right now if I had distanced myself from NA? Like a lot of people do, because, you know, I've got a really good life. Like, I have a really good job. I have a career. You know, I, like, don't, you know, I could convince myself that I really don't need to still come to meetings. But, you know, since I've gone through the loss of my husband, like, I think about that a lot. Like, where would I be if I had done that? You know, you all would not be my friends anymore, and I would have nobody for real. And I probably, maybe, you know, would be using. So I have a really old friend named Wallace, who used to live in Baltimore, and then he deserted us and went to the West Coast. I was really mad at him for that. I remember, and when I think about like how I thought like back in the early days, it's like so crazy, because Wallace went to the West Coast. He was the regional delegate, went to the World Service Conference, met a woman who lived in the West Coast, and he moved out there to be with her. And I was so mad at him, I could not understand how he could do that to me. He was my best friend. Like, how could he leave me like that? It was terrible, you know, not like, oh, I'm so happy for you, you know. It's like, well, how can you do this to me? I remember begging him the day he came by my house. He was in his car out in front of my house. He came by to say goodbye. You're the last person I wanted to come and see you. And I'm like, and I'm standing there begging him not to go. That is crazy. But anyway, Wallace used to say to me all the time, whatever you do, don't ever cut your umbilical cord to NA. Mm-hmm. Don't ever cut it. And that, you know, is something that really like hit home with me, and that I thought about a lot, especially during those times when my life got really busy and I'm working, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, and I'm like, I'm too tired, you know. I have a job where I'm helping people, like that's my service, you know. And I could really, there were times when I really started to convince myself that, you know, I just didn't need to go to NA anymore. And then I would hear Wallace. I would hear Wallace's voice say, don't cut that umbilical cord, don't do it. And I'm so grateful that I never have, and I hope that I never will. And whatever the reason is why I'm still here today, I'm really glad that I am. So thanks for letting me share. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda. And now our next speaker, Danny S.
That would be me. I'm an addict. My name's Danny. Oh, wow. I just hugged Rhonda. It's like, who would have thunk it? You know? Yeah, really. You know? Like, Rhonda had a year clean when I got clean, which was like, it's God, and then my sponsor, and then Gina. You know, Gina had a year. You know, and she used to tell me.
No, she didn't. I have more
pizza.
She's got more.
Not Gina. I'm sorry. I was looking at Gina. Okay. No, I'm just old. You know, I just, wherever I'm looking, that's what I say. You know? But the interesting thing about that, you know, the situation that Rhonda shared with you about me going over there that night, somebody had done that for me, exact same way. I wasn't going to use though. I was going to kill myself. And it made perfect sense. It made perfect sense. Thing in my head said, and I called my sponsor at the time, and I got his answering machine. Yeah, that was before voicemails, fellas. It was a little boxes that used to sit on the coffee table. And I made one more phone call, and he told me to hold on. And he set the phone down and left me sitting there holding the phone. And he came over, and he took the gun, and we sat up and talked the whole night. And that was a pivotal point for me, because after we had talked back and forth until almost dawn, he asked me, he said, are you entirely ready? Are you ready? When I first came around, and my home group was in a AA clubhouse, and a little room, not much bigger than this room. Okay, and at that point, I wanted to stay clean. I didn't want to use. I didn't want to use, but I wasn't quite sure whether or not Narcotics Anonymous was the answer. I didn't think that was really going to work for me. You know, I was a complicated individual. I had complicated problems. I was unique as hell. You know, and somewhere in the back of my head, I thought you would need to fly me to like Sweden, and there'd be a crew of, you know, experts that would work on me around the clock. And, but something as simple as a 12-step program and a room full of recovering addicts. And so I was coming to meetings, and I would sit down in the back of the room. And sometimes it was hard for me to hear the speaker sharing, because my disease was on his shoulder talking to me. And I don't know if any of you had that, okay? But mine was sitting on the shoulder. I don't know if you remember, what was that, Fred Flintstone, that had the good Fred and the bad Fred? Okay, yeah. And he would sit on my shoulder, and he would be in my ear the whole meeting. I couldn't even hear the person that was sharing, because he was saying, you can get one more. Get one more. And it would hit me with this one. Won't nobody know. Nobody know. And I was holding on, grit teeth and white knuckles. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in prayer. I was just holding on. A day at a time, an hour at a time, a minute at a time. And I started experiencing what I understand now was loneliness. I'm a social being. I didn't understand what drove it until later in my process, but I'm a social being. And you told me to get rid of people, places, and things, but I wanted to be able to pick up the phone and hear somebody on the other end that was glad to hear from me. I wanted to hear, hey, boy, what's up? What you doing? Where you at? I wanted that. But I was going into these meetings, and I would just sit down, and at the end of the meeting, I'd stand in a circle, bam, gone. And I knew I was going to need to do something different, or I was going to use. And I made up my mind that I was going to reach out to somebody. And I, for the life of me, I don't know why it was so hard for me to do that. But to walk up to a stranger and ask him for his name and his number, and ask him if I could call him and talk to him. But I'd gone to this meeting, and I picked a guy at the beginning of the meeting, and I said, I'm going to ask him. Went through the whole meeting, didn't hear shit, right? At the end of the meeting, I walked right up to him, and was like, my name's Danny, can I get your number? Mm-hmm. I'm new. It was like that. So he gave me his number, and I called him that night, and we talked, I don't know, about an hour. I have no idea what we talked about. But the interesting thing happened was the next day when I went up there and I walked in the room and he was there. And he turned around and looked at me. He said, Danny, what's up? Give me a hug. And then he said, look, come here, I want you to meet. And I go, come here, I want you to come on, meet Danny. And I got to a point I was going into that meeting and it was like, hey, Danny. And 34 years later, I still need that. Hey, baby. I still need that. You see, I have low self-esteem and low self-worth. If you see me out moving around, you're going to see my mask. And I love it when I get here and I go to these speaker jams and the conventions, and they have that workshop, you know, removing the mask. And I hear somebody say, yeah, I worked step 6 and 7 and I removed the mask. I'm like, well, bless your heart. mine is like a tattoo. It's permanently implanted. And if you see me moving around more often than not, you're going to see confident, self-assured. Got to worry about the balls. It's not true. Inside is a frightened little boy that doesn't measure up. Afraid you're not going to like him. And I don't want you to see who I really am. You know, I have worked for 66 years to master this illusion. And sometimes the only thing I can do is peep from behind it, like Oz, you know, pulling the curtain back and showing you who I really am, telling you who I really am. Don't believe what you see. Hear what I'm saying. Hear what I'm saying. A lot of my damage runs deep, you know, and I can't manage this on my own. I have a disease that will convince me that self-destruction makes perfect sense. Okay. Alarm clock goes off, I hit the snooze button. That moment, you're just kind of laying there, your eyes closed, you know what I'm saying? But that moment, okay? And I'm tired, and I don't understand why I'm tired, because I got plenty of sleep last night. Why am I so tired? You know, but I got to get up, I got to go to work. But I'm tired. I'm just tired. Maybe I should call in. Can't do that. Because if you call in, they're going to write you up. And they told you if they write you up again, they're going to suspend you. But then they also told you if you get suspended again, you're going to get fired. But I'm tired. Why am I tired? And then I remember a good friend of mine suffered liver disease, and he was feeling fatigue a lot, right? But I gotta go to work. If I don't go to work, I'm gonna get fired. And if I get fired, I'm gonna get pulled out of my apartment. Now, I have not been awake for 2 minutes, and I'm already unemployed, homeless, and dying from liver cancer. And at 12 o'clock, I'm at work feeling like crap, and I can't understand what the problem is. The reason I stay is because I cannot go unsupervised. But I did once. And I did not understand. You know how, you know, when you hear people, you know, you start talking about the eighth step and you're writing your eighth step list, and one of the first names you put on the eighth step is yours. And that was the hardest one for me to make amends to myself, because I fucked up my life. I had the opportunity to do some things. I can learn, I can read, I could have been able to go to college or the university, and I could have gotten some degrees, and I could have, you know, I could have been a doctor, or I could have been a professor, I could have done some things. I fucked my life up. And I ended up in a situation where I ended up working in an atmosphere, in a place where some doors started opening up. And I said, wow, I got a chance. I got a shot. And I bet the farm. And I'm working like 7 days a week. I'm working 12-hour days. But I wasn't going to meetings. And I'm doing good. Things are starting to bam, 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 bam. But I'm not going to meetings. And one of the misfortunes in my process is I have two sisters in recovery. And nobody can take your inventory better than two sisters that have taken inventories themselves, right? And I'm getting you're not going to meetings no more? And this is how my disease works. I come up with some really slick shit. Well, look, you need to understand that by the time that you get to this point in your recovery, you know, early on, you know, you are in critical care, you know, and then you move on. You know, you get discharged. And I would stop in my home group sometimes, you know, for somebody's anniversary, you know, and I would do certain things. I would go out to the regional convention because to let you all know everything's okay because I'm here. And I went out to the regional and I'm walking around, I'm hugging people, letting them know, so, yeah, you're doing fine. You're doing fine. NA's great. I just wanted to check and make sure everybody. Oh, give me a hug. Thank you. Okay. And I heard a buddy of mine named Kelvin was doing a workshop, and I said, I'm going to go check out Kelvin. And I go up in there, and Kelvin's sharing, and Kelvin starts talking about what he's doing. And Kelvin was doing some stuff. And I was like, crossed my legs, and was like, yeah, Kelvin, will you explain this shit to them? And he was talking, at that point, he was working on his second master's degree. He was sole caretaker for his elderly parents. He was starting his own business. I was like, will you explain this to them? Anytime I'm in his sponsees want to know how come he's not going to meetings. I was like, well, go ahead, explain it. Explain it, Kelvin. And he said he forgot. He forgot the insidious nature of this disease. And that this disease will take all of my good works and draw me out. So it has me by myself. And when I was sitting there in that meeting, I was like, fuck me. Now, I don't know. I'm one of those that is very, very grateful for a loving God. Very grateful for a loving God. Because I'm the one that ends up dangling from the tree limb by my fingertips, and I don't even know how I got in the tree. Like, how the fuck did I get in? I have done more to sabotage my recovery over the years. Alright? And it's only been through God's grace that I have not self-destructed. And the men and women in this program, I need supervision. I need supervision. Now, this past year has been hard on some, harder on others. It wasn't until, you know, they said, you know, you have to stay home and you can't be around anybody. And I was like, cool. And I just got realized that's how antisocial I really was in the first place. But I had a friend of mine call me and she was like, look, why don't you come to my home group? I said, girl, you in North Carolina? And she said, yeah, we're virtual. I said, like on the computer? And she said, yeah. I was like, get the fuck. I ain't going to no meeting on the computer. And I went as a curiosity. I'm going to just check it out. Right? And I'm sitting there and I'm going like, this is some crazy shit. Right? And then I went the next night. And I went the next night. And then one night it was like, look, when we leave this meeting, we're going to a meeting in Morocco.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, you know, it's like we're going to a meeting in London. Get the fuck out. Yeah, okay. You know? And how cool is it though? You know, I can log into a meeting in London and I come online and there's about three or four guys and say, hey mate. Hey mate. And I log into a traditions meeting out in the Philippines. And I log in, it's like, Dani! Hey, Dani! And it still works. Over this past year, I've established intimate relationships with people I've never been in the same room with. and men that I've given permission to supervise me. And you see, it's one thing having somebody, you know, having another recovering addict, you know, a therapeutic value, but when you give somebody permission, I trust you. And I can share with you exactly what's going on and then shut up and let them help me. Now, I have a great relationship with my sponsor. But that second step talks about a power greater than myself. You all are the power greater than me. We ain't even getting to the God piece yet. When I expose myself to you and I tell you exactly what's going on and I get to the exact nature and it's like, this is what's happening, and then I shut up and I let you help me. And I trust you with my life. And I have men and women in my life that I'll do that with. Now, I'm going to share this and I'm shutting up. Relationships has never been my strong suit. relationships that I've been in have always end up either in resentment, anger, you know, they always, it's just the same. You know, fuck you, no, fuck you, no, fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. And about 2.5 years ago, I got involved with a woman that I loved dearly. And I was going to do this, right? But I didn't know how. And I knew my track record was screwing up. But I had some men in my life that said, come on, we're going to walk through this with you. I remember at one point when things were kind of looking a little shaky, and I was like, look, we're going to sit down and have a conversation. We're going to talk about this shit. And he says, well, what you going to say to her? I said, well, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say that, and I'm going to say this, that, and the other. He said, no. You're not going to say any of that. Well, what am I going to do? He said, listen. And when she came in that evening, and she sat down on the edge of the bed, and I just sat down on a chair in front of the bed and just sat there, and she began to talk, and I understood, and I heard her, and when she started to cry, I just got up, walked over and put my arms around her, and I held her, and I was like, wow, that's some cool shit, you know. But I started taking risks and I started doing things I'd never done before. You know, she was moving into my house. And I'm like, I understand that this is a big step for her. So I'm going to make my house our house. And I started doing things, ripped up carpet, laid hardwood floors, retiled the kitchen and the bathroom, painted the place, laid new carpet, everything. I did all this kind of stuff, you know. And here we go. I'm having fun. I was loving it. I was like, yeah, I like this shit. I like this shit here. And but after a while, she started drifting away, and I saw it. But I'm on the phone with powers greater than me. And I'm talking and I'm sharing. And they're sharing back with me. Okay? And the end result, I ended up sending her a text message and I said, how long are we going to prolong the inevitable? And she came over. She didn't want to come in the house. She was too upset. And she got out the car, she sat on the steps, and we sat on the steps together, and we talked. And I told her my part. I said, I know now, when you came to me, you came looking for someplace safe. Something comfortable, something familiar. I said, and I turned that into a relationship. And she said, you didn't do it by yourself. And I said, well, this isn't going to work for me. And she said, I know. And we hugged and we cried. And then I said something stupid like, you know, well, come on, let's like really act out and make a fool in front of the neighbors, you know. But I went into it with my integrity. I went into it with character. I went into it with dignity. And it was important that I was able to come out of it that way. But every step of the way, I had some men and women in my ear. I would not have been able to do this alone. And that's it. I can't do this on my own. I have experienced some wonderful things over the last nearly 34 years. And, I mean, wonderful things. But I could not have done any of it without each and every one of you. And continuing to give you all permission to help me. So, if you see me unsupervised, you know, it's like getting on the walkie-talkie. He's alone. Somebody grab him. And it's okay. And it's okay. You know, I couldn't have done this thing without you. Thank you for letting me share. I love you very much.
Thank you, Danny, and thank you, Rhonda. Yeah. If I'm reading this correctly, and I will take the liberty, and if I do, I get in trouble, then it's okay. It says Mike, so I'm thinking that for the next 30 minutes, it's open, right? That's what I think.
No, I'm not. And we have to take a group picture. There's a group picture. But you can do whatever you want.
No, tell me. I don't know. My schedule, excuse me, my schedule says, okay, wait a minute.
Then you close it.
I close it. Okay. Oh, okay, what do I know? Okay, Rhonda and I had a conversation. Wait a minute, hold on a second, everyone. I will do what? Okay, so here it says, restate, no, we did that already. Okay, so I'm going to thank Rhonda and Danny for a great meeting. It says it ends at 7:30, that's why. Okay? So we'll close with the Serenity Prayer.